School's out. That phrase used to be a happy one, but at the moment there's little joy in saying school is out because it is out unintentionally. The coronavirus pandemic and the need to keep people from gathering in groups closed the schools and sent the kids home. And many parents are idled too, so yay, homeschool, unintentionally. That makes this a great time to talk about homeschooling on purpose, and Julie Bogart of the Homeschool Alliance is an expert on that. Julie is a writer at heart with degrees in history and theology. She freelances and ghostwrites and edits and created the Brave Writer Program 2 decades ago to help parents to help their kids express themselves in writing. Julie homeschooled each of her 5 children and founded the Homeschool Alliance. Her latest book is The Brave Learner. Julie Bogart, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
Same here. So Brave Writer and Brave Learner, why Brave?
Well, I bet a lot of parents could tell you why now.
No doubt.
It takes some courage, really, to take on the full responsibility of both parenting and educating simultaneously. And what I've noticed over the last 30 years that I've been involved with homeschoolers is that they are courageous people. They have gone outside the mainstream. They're choosing to find their own way. They're teaching subjects that maybe weren't their strengths when they were students. So there is a degree of courage that goes with this task. And now we've got all these parents who, you know, unexpectedly found themselves in this camp that they never dreamed in 100 years would be theirs. And I consider them quite brave, actually.
Yeah, it is a unique situation at the moment, absolutely. Were you homeschooled yourself, Julie?
I was not. Nope. I come from what we call the generation of people who sort of took that risk to do it, and our kids would be considered first gen. But there are second generation homeschoolers now, and it's an increasing number all the time. I used to ask at conferences if anyone had been homeschooled, and they would say no, there'd be zero people. And now I'd say a good 20% of my audiences were homeschooled themselves.
So what made you decide to teach your kids? What motivated other people in the first generation?
Yeah, lots of different reasons. Mine were somewhat unique. I was living abroad in a Muslim country at the time. My husband was working as a university professor, and I knew a lot of other expatriates who homeschooled. So I got interested in it because of that. But by the time we moved to the States, that's when my son was ready to start school, and I had done so much reading about the value of this sort of family community learning experience and interest-led learning, and I just wasn't ready for him to leave me. I was like, well, this is going really well. Why would I send him to school? So that's how I got started. And of course, you know, once you get involved in the community that is homeschooling, you develop a whole way of life that we really loved. I mean, it was wonderful for us.
But lest anybody think that you were an instant expert, I mean, you're an expert now, but back then you did not always feel like you knew what you were doing, you report.
100%. And in fact, I think that the only time you think you knew what you were doing is once your kids are, you know, well-paid adults in a job. When you're going through any aspect of parenting, it is a learning-on-the-job kind of situation. And adding the responsibility for your children's full education just ups the ante. What I learned over the years, and maybe the key understanding to pass along today, is that it is an unfolding journey. It's something that you can learn over time in process. And these parents who are stuck at home right now with, you know, Zoom meetings with their teachers and packets to fill out, that isn't the kind of homeschooling I did, of course. You know, I had time to do research, and I went to conferences, and my kids were in a homeschool co-op with 100 other families that met once a week. So even homeschoolers right now are thrown for a big loop. This is a very unique situation, and it creates a lot of stress and a different kind of pressure for all of us.
Well, you know, we did talk to the board president of the Oregon Home Education Network last week, and one of the first things she said, number one, relax.
Yes, yes. Number one, in fact, I was sharing this morning on Instagram, there are no educational emergencies. We're all living right now in an emergency, and we are operating from a sort of unspoken alarm around toilet paper, food rationing, how we are going to take care of the dog, get our kids outside so they get some fresh air, worry about contracting the virus or loved ones dying. These are real emergencies, but education is not. Education is a slow drip, drip, drip over time of increasing understanding and moments of epiphany where the insight crystallizes and it really becomes your own. And so during this very strange season where alarm is high, sometimes we transfer that to our children through the educational piece. So if you've got a child who's got the math packet that she's got to do for third grade, maybe just recognize that you're not going to get it all done in an hour like you would in a class. Maybe you need to just take it 10 minutes a day and pair it with cookies and make a pot of tea and maybe even pick some wildflowers outside and make a nice little arrangement for her to look at and do it together. Don't stand over her, you know, taller, taskmaster-like, but sit beside her. Gather all the kids at the table and allow yourself to sort of lean into it at a slower pace. I like to say go slow to go fast. You know, allow yourself to ease into it.
I noticed the pot of tea. There's a lot of tea in your life, isn't there? Chocolate,
you know,
too.
Tea is real, and coffee is, too. It's a metaphor as much as it is the reality, though. When you change the context of how a child is learning, you allow them to be more receptive. So one of the things I share a lot on these interviews is school and home are nothing alike. School is a building designed to herd, you know, hundreds or thousands of students through a system, 30 children at a time with one instructor facing the front of the room with a bunch of rules that help deliver that content. It's appropriate to that context. But when you come home, you kick off your shoes, you relax. You don't want anyone telling you what to do. You want to be yourself. And that feels like an oil and water mix when you try to enforce the principles of school on the properties of home.
Okay, we'll pick it up there on the other side of a break. Julie Bogart, great, our guest, a homeschooling expert, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Our guest is Julie Bogart, who is the creator of the Brave Writer Program 2 decades ago and the founder of the Homeschool Alliance. She homeschooled her 5 kids and still recommends it to the rest of the world as a way to do things. And of course, it is kind of the order of the day at the moment for most of us because the kids have their schools closed. A lot of parents are at home as well because their businesses have been closed or at least they're working from home. So a real opportunity for parents to get to know a little bit more about their child's educations in ways they never really intended. On Instagram, it says, straight talk about homeschool. Welcome suddenly at homeschoolers too. We see you. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I did notice too the Instagram post about you may have eaten all the chocolate by day 10 of the confinement.
That definitely happened in my house.
We have to hide it from ourselves at our house too. Yeah. So you were just talking about the difference, though, that, you know, that the roles of homeschool and public school or big school or you know, school outside
right,
the home.
Traditional school,
yeah,
right?
Really, really different kinds of things. You do get to kick off your shoes. You're at home. So let's talk about the role of the parent because you're still the parent. I mean, maybe you're the teacher, yeah, but you're still the parent. And you pointed this out in your work, too, I've noticed.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're in the home, what I've discovered is you've got these two agendas. You know you want your kids to get an education, to do the schoolwork that has been assigned to them, but they also have this sort of unconscious inner sense that they shouldn't have to behave the way they do in school. So what we do is we try to do the yin and the yang. We pair the coziness of home with the school or academic expectations. So one of the, you know, what we call the gateway drug to Brave Writer is something I created called Poetry Tea Time. And basically, this is what happened. I love poetry as an adult, but most of the adults I meet don't love it. But pretty much everyone esteems it as a prestige subject. You know, it's sort of like chess or violin. We all look up to it, but we aren't all good at it. And many of us are intimidated by it. So I didn't want my children to grow up with this dysfunctional relationship to a subject I actually loved. So I thought about, well, what do they love? Well, in our house, they really loved tea parties. I was a big British tea drinker. A lot of times I'd pour tea for them just because they were interested in the teapot. And so one day I suggested to my daughter, why don't we make muffins, set the table for a tea party. I'll pull out grandma's china teacups. We'll light candles. And then we're going to read. And I just stacked up the table with all these poetry books and everyone just took a turn reading a poem. For my little toddlers, they'd just point to a page, and I'd read the poem for them. And it was like a runaway train. Pretty soon, they wanted to have poetry tea time every single day, because suddenly the learning was seated in something special, something they valued. And I suddenly discovered this was true across the board. They might not want to sit at the table to do their spelling or their handwriting, but they would sit on the couch with a clipboard tucked into a blanket, petting the dog. So I started to look for ways to incorporate the strengths of home with the academic expectations, and we noticed that we were just having a much happier, more successful time.
Who helped you in those days? I mean, if you were the first generation of homeschoolers, where did you turn to for help before you formed the Homeschool Alliance?
We turned to each other. So I was fortunate. There was a friend of mine, I talk about her in my book, in fact, named Dottie, who had kids who were just a little older than mine. Her youngest was the same age as my oldest child. And we happened to live in the same condo unit. So it was Southern California, perfect weather every day, and we would just collaborate a lot. We had a lot of what I would call homeschool parties. Like, I remember one time we wanted to help our kids really understand the solar system. So we all got outside and we decided to make every single mile of the solar system like a fraction of an inch. And then we set our kids apart on our cul-de-sac to show them the distances. And we suddenly realized that the child who was going to be Pluto would have to be miles away from us to complete the solar system. And that was like a revelation to me, even as an adult, because I had never actually done it tangibly, right? I had only ever seen it discussed in a book. So homeschooling got built in these neighborhoods, among friends, in church groups, where people were congregating who homeschooled, and we were figuring it out together. I used to do a monthly brunch with five of my friends. We'd go to Mimi's Cafe, and we would map out learning parties for the year, and each family would do two a year, so we'd end up with 10. And those are the ways we grew together. We had books to read. There were books about homeschooling. But this is all before the internet, by the way. So
right.
It was very grassrootsy.
Julie Bogart is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a homeschooling expert. Wrote a book last year called The Brave Learner. Do parents have to be different with their kids as teacher than as parent? I mean, do you need to like slip a different hat on, take a different attitude, act like a teacher?
I would say no. Now, it's the temptation of every parent who's ever homeschooled, and it's the temptation of every parent trying to implement school at home. But here's what is really awesome about being with your kids in learning. There are two things they need from you. One, they need your admiration. They're not looking to disappoint you or fail you. So when they say, I hate math, I don't want to write, spelling is stupid, what they're really telling you is, if I take this risk and attempt it in front of you, you're going to be disappointed because I can't do it well enough yet. I'm not going to perform at the level you want me to. It's not going to be easy for me. So I'm just going to say I don't like it. And then a parent goes into teacher mode, which is, you know, carrot and stick. You can't play your video game until you finish spelling. Mm-hmm. Or if you finish spelling, you can play your video game, right? It's one of those two things. What I recommend instead is collaboration. Sit next to your child and be an ally and a partner. We have a saying in Brave Writer called, help helps. And that's your job as a parent. You would never have said to your child who couldn't tie her shoe yet, well, I've already shown you how, and you can't play your video game until you learn to tie your shoe. I'm leaving the room. You know, you just wouldn't do that. They're learning how to do their own laundry. You stand there and you make sure they pour in the right ingredients. You don't just leave them and then come back and give them an F because they put bleach in with the coloreds. There is an understanding of parenting that allows us to be that partner that we forget around education. And homeschooling invites that back in. Be a partner. Show them your own frustration. Show them how you learn. Narrate out loud. You know, I remember I had to reteach myself how to find common denominators. I'm not that great at math. And in fact, the first time I did it, I hid in the garage and tried to reteach myself so my son wouldn't know that I didn't know. I came back in. And I said, okay, honey, I'm ready to teach you. So he's good at math, so he caught on very quickly. He finished the page, and he turned to me and he said, so, Mom, you only need to know how to do fractions when you're an adult teaching them to kids and when you're a kid. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, didn't you just go teach them to yourself in the garage? This is the stuff you learn when you homeschool over time. And, of course, that child today is a computer programmer. Huh. Even my limits in math didn't stop him. But there is sort of this honesty about home education where you can really share in the learning journey with your children and let them see you, not as an expert all the time, but as a willing partner.
So how did you deal with your now computer programmer child when it appeared that he was going to outstrip you in math? I mean, potentially he could have moved into calculus and stuff and would have left you in the dust, I would think.
Oh, and he did. Oh, he completely did. So there are a lot of homeschoolers now. And we had a co-op that had 100 families in it. And the math classes were taught by engineers and math people. I taught all the writing, literature, and theater classes because that's my area of expertise. I also, at one point, did a tutoring exchange. One of my friends is, I always called her the abacus. She's a Chinese Malay PhD in math, like the smartest person I know. And she didn't feel as comfortable teaching writing. So we swapped. I taught all of her kids academic essay forms, and she taught math all the way through pre-calc. So there, we have solutions. It doesn't mean I have to teach everything. It's more like becoming the educational coordinator as they get into those upper grades.
Well, and that gets into the whole thing that we can talk about as we move into the second half of this conversation. Let me remind our listeners, we're talking to Julie Bogart, who is all about homeschooling. She's the creator of the Brave Writer Program, wrote another book last year called The Brave Learner, which is all about homeschooling, founded the Homeschool Alliance. You can join this conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So now the thing I was getting excited about is a friend of mine once said that my son wanted guidance when he was younger. When he got older, he really wanted a consultant.
I love it. I love it.
I guess I'm getting ahead of myself, but I do want to ask about, you know, so how do you be able to make the transitions and realize when it's time to be, okay, you know, I'm going to stand back a little more now and just watch the work. But there's a lot of observing that goes on for the parent as teacher.
Oh my goodness. You are such a genius. No one has ever said that to me on a phone call. I'm so impressed. I say all the time, you're a detective mom, you're a detective dad. Your biggest job is to get to know your individual child. They are not, you know, Joe student, average pace, matching the Common Core. They're a unique human being. Some kids will be very advanced in math, advanced compared to peers, but quote-unquote behind in writing compared to peers, and yet exactly who they should be at this moment in time. So yes, you're observing. Some kids will need more help in some subjects than others. So I have this practice that I did with my kids. I like to sit next to them whenever we're doing something brand new. And I like doing it together in conversation, narrating what they're doing, saying the words out loud, like, oh, see, honey, you just put a single digit in the tens column. That's carrying, and that's actually representing a 10. Saying it out loud, so they're hearing you describe it, letting them feel inside of themselves the story they're building about how to do these problems, this writing, understanding history. As they show a little proficiency, then I recommend moving like one counter space away. You might say, honey, try that problem. I'm just going to load the dishwasher. So you leave the table, but you're within shouting distance. So they can say, oh, I'm stuck, or I don't understand this, or I'm already done because I can't go any further. And then you can just drop the dishes and come back and partner some more. Then later you test it by actually leaving the room. You say, I'm going to go do a load of laundry down in the basement. So you actually physically disappear from the room, but only for 3 minutes. You come back and you see how they're doing. This is how you build stamina in learning. Nobody would say to their child, okay, I've explained to you how to drive a car. Here are the keys. Go take an hour, and I need you to be an independent driver, so I'm not going to be in this passenger seat with you. We know that because that's actually physically dangerous. But it's also academically dangerous to send a child into work with only instruction, without modeling, without talking to them as they start to make decisions or choices that could become habits that are not appropriate. And I'll give you a little example. When I was in third grade, we used to have these time tests. I was in a traditional elementary public school where they would do one times table, like the twos, mm-hmm. you know, or one math table, like all the three pluses. And we would have a minute to complete them. And whoever finished first and got them all right got a Disney eraser from Disneyland. This is before the Disney store. This is like 1960s in L.A. Well, I was a really fast writer, so I won a handful of these erasers because I could get them done very quickly. But I didn't understand multiplication. I did great with addition. So on the zeros and ones, I actually transposed the zeros for the ones, and I got all the answers wrong. But I finished first, and because I had won a lot of erasers, my teacher gave me the eraser, took my paper, and as I was making my way back to the seat, she said, "Oh, Julie, you got them all wrong. Bring back the eraser."
Ugh.
In front of the whole class, humiliation. She never sat down with me and showed me what I misunderstood. Fast forward to age 34, my son is in fourth grade. We're working on common denominators, fractions, and we are using these Cuisenaire rods, or these little units of length. And for the first time, I understood that multiplication meant multiples. I had never realized it was three threes, three fours, three fives. I just was memorizing straight facts and didn't memorize them very well. That could have been avoided if I had been sitting with an adult who could have sat with me and heard me narrate what I was thinking about. So I tried to practice this with my daughter. I said, okay, let's do two times two, and let's do it with shells, you know, regrouping. And I left her to go change a diaper, and I came back, and she had made a perfect-shaped two, a perfect-shaped X, another perfect-shaped two out of shells. And I went, oh, my gosh, she's doing what I did. She does not understand regrouping. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what homeschooling affords you, the observation, the narrating, the support, the help, till they've really got it.
Well, it does seem like a lot of the issues that crop up for people as adults are things that if they had been caught and corrected earlier in life, it's sort of like the asteroid thing. If you divert it way back there, you don't have to give it much gravity.
Yes.
But if it gets really close, it's going to be a hell of a push. So that early in life, making those little corrections in somebody's education quickly, you know, when they first make the mistake,
right.
is like, oh, yeah, I see what you did here.
And what's happening now, parents are used to supporting homework. For the first time, they're being invited into thinking about how this subject is functioning in an ongoing way in their child. And that can be a really exciting process if you see yourself as an ally and not as the responsible taskmaster. So sit with your children, be interested in how their minds work, and you will find solutions much more easily.
You know, you mentioned moving a counter space away if you want the child to work on something for a couple of minutes, you know, then
right.
if you're feeling more confident, move a room away, you know, go into the basement,
right.
do the laundry, that sort of thing. So which raises just a really basic structural question. Should there be a quote unquote school area in your home?
Yeah, I love this question. Every brand new homeschooler creates a homeschooling room,
uh-huh.
every single one, and they are out of it in 2 months because it's a house. And you live in it. You're in it all day. You never leave it. So if you stay only in the homeschool room for all the work and learning, you're actually not taking advantage of all the benefits of being in a big house and not just a classroom. You've got couches. You can make food. You can have one child upstairs on your king-size bed watching TV while you're downstairs doing sort of the documentary with your older kids that you don't want the toddler to see. Like, take advantage of the whole space. If there's nothing wrong with having a room that's got all the books in it and a nice desk and maybe a wall map, but just know you're not going to stay there. You're going to move around.
Right. Let's talk about enchantment in education. We're getting close to a break, but I want to at least broach this subject about what you mean by enchantment in education.
So I discovered that my kids were the most eager to learn when I seized on four different forces: surprise, mystery, risk, and adventure. Little kids especially love surprises. You know, they mix a batter that's all wet. You put it inside this one little container, turn on some heat, stick it in an oven, and suddenly it comes out like a cake. For us, that's so old hat. We don't even realize how magical that is for a child. a surprise like waking up in the morning and there is a brand new deck of cards sitting at her breakfast table chair, and she's like, cards to play with. Surprise invites children into exploration. You know, looking through a telescope or a kaleidoscope, being able to use a variety of markers, not just a pencil. You get to choose your own color. Surprise is an ally in learning. Mystery is that depth that you don't know everything about it and you keep learning more. Risk is the ability to take a risk and know you're safe. You're not going to get in trouble if you get it wrong. And then, of course, adventure is harder to have right now. We're all indoors.
Right. Okay. We'll come back to adventure in just a moment. Right. Julie Bogart, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a homeschooling expert, the founder of the Homeschool Alliance, homeschooled 5 kids herself. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. We were just talking about enchantment and education, comprised of surprise, mystery, risk, and adventure. I want to go back to risk. I feel like we might have given that short shrift. What kinds of things do you see in that category?
So sometimes, because school is oriented usually towards content mastery, children don't feel as free to take risks because they're trying to get good grades. So a classic example would be in writing. You focus more on the accuracy of your content than the riskiness of what you want to convey. Perhaps a child is in third or fourth grade. You know, if you talk to them about their video game or their Minecraft build, they're going to use this really elaborate vocabulary, sometimes words you don't even know, and they're going to tell you a lot of detail. And then you ask them to write it down, and they get paralyzed because they don't know how to spell all those big words yet. They don't know how to punctuate those great complex sentences. And so they feel like they're supposed to deliver to you a perfectly spelled, perfectly punctuated piece of writing. And so they dumb down the content to try and approximate and match their mechanical skills. In Brave Writer and in homeschooling, I like to encourage risk. I would be much more interested in a child misspelling every word if I could get that sophisticated speech, that elaborate vocabulary, that quirky sense of humor, the, you know, sentence variety that is so natural to them when they're speaking. If I could get them to write that down, I don't worry about the punctuation and the spelling at the beginning. I want them to risk exposing their true thoughts, even though they don't have the full set of skills yet. That's an example of what I mean by risk. And you have to create a safe environment for it. They have to know that you're going to bite your tongue. You're not going to evaluate their handwriting, that you are going to laser focus on the genius of the idea or the cleverness of the vocabulary or the sensitivity of the insight.
So these requirements will change a bit from state to state, but as a homeschool parent, what are the requirements in terms of giving grades? I mean, how do you test for the strength of the knowledge? I mean, obviously in a homeschool system, the way you're talking about it, kids can take greater risks and make mistakes, I guess, for longer, make them bigger, something, yes, as a way to know where to eventually get.
Yes, exactly. And like in Brave Writer, we separate the mechanics. We teach them, but we don't teach them using a student's original writing. We use someone else's writing. We take passages out of Laura Ingalls Wilder or E.B. White, and we copy them, and we use them for dictation, and we discuss the mechanics of writing. But we're more and more careful with that original content. Grading, as a rule, is a tool to convey a message from a teacher to a parent. They're basically saying, you weren't in the classroom, so you don't really know how your child's doing compared to other kids. So here's a grade that gives you a snapshot of my impression of how your child's doing. But a grade itself doesn't have a lot of meaning, because if your child doesn't know something, they don't know it. The grade doesn't teach it. They still have to learn it. So what we do in homeschooling generally is parents either use year-end testing if their state requires it, or they have in many states the option of what we call a year-end narrative. You meet with a teacher, you bring a collection of the schoolwork you've done over the year. It's like show and tell for the parent. And you sit with this educator and you say, look what Johnny did, look what Sarah did, I'm so proud of them. And then you discuss ideas for how to work on weak areas or ideas for how to grow a strength. We discuss resources. And then that teacher sends a certification into the state saying, yep, those students improved. And that's how it is in most states. There are some states where there are no regulations, like Kentucky and Texas, but most of them have some version of that.
Let's get a phone call in here from Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Julie Bogart as we talk about homeschooling.
Hello there. Yes, I'd like to thank you for sharing all your experience about teaching your children at home. My own background is I'm a retired community college person who worked in special education, students with disabilities. So I'd like to know what your experience is with in the field of what do parents do to find out their children have a learning disability, or how are they taught to identify learning disabilities? I have several questions, but I'll keep it to two. And the second thing is, how did you teach critical thinking skills to your high school age children to prepare them for taking college exams and going to college?
Okay, excellent questions, Vince. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, Vince. God, I love both those questions. First of all, I had a son who had dysgraphia and another one with ADHD, so I have some experience personally. But we've also found that a lot of special needs kids do best at home. It's not that they won't still use a tutorial service or meet with a specialist, an SLP, someone to help them, but they have more time, they have more intimacy, and they are able to accommodate those learning challenges in a way that helps the child retain a sense of, you know, self-esteem and dignity while they are growing in those skills. So there are lots and lots of programs now that accommodate homeschoolers and that make that a possibility. And both of my kids took advantage of outside tutoring and support during those years. The second question is my favorite and actually, you know, sneak peek. My next book is called Raising Critical Thinkers.
Oh, boy.
And it is my passion as an educator to raise critical thinkers. Homeschoolers have been vilified as being narrow, as being not open-minded. But what I have seen is that if we invest deeply in literature, documentaries, cross-cultural experiences, giving them a wide, deep, and rich education, and then teaching parents how to ask the kinds of questions that grow the rhetorical imagination, they do quite well, better than their peers in some cases, because their dialogue partners are often adults. So, yes, a great question, total passion of mine.
We have another question. This is an email from Jacob in Gold Hill. He wants to know if you teach writing to adults who want to be freelance writers. If so, how does one access your talent or someone whom you might recommend? And which of your books address the issues of adult writers? Again, that's from Jacob in Gold Hill.
Thank you, Jacob. We do not teach adult writers, but I do know because my mother is a professional author. She worked for a company called Longridge for years, which is an online professional writing service. And you could look into that.
Longridge. Okay. I have to take a look for that. Let's talk about transitions as the kids get older. I mean, and you talked about moving away and giving a little more space and stuff. I mean, by the time that your kids had gotten off into the later high school years, were you pretty much leaving them alone a good bit of the day?
Yes. Now, I would just a full telling, true confession, whatever. I had multiple kids who did go to high school. So one of them went, one of them went all 4 years, another one went 3 years, another one did 2.5 years, and then one of them did part-time enrollment, and the fifth one, who was my oldest, he tried it and hated it. So everybody had a different experience. We took advantage of Ohio's opportunity to do dual enrollment. So you could take, let's say, French, theater, and British literature at school and do math, history, Latin, and, you know, whatever else you wanted to do at home. My kids all took advantage of community classes as well. One student took classes at our local zoo academy. Another one took Greek at University of Xavier here in Cincinnati when I was taking that class. Many homeschooled students do community college. You will also find co-ops that cater to that older level. So when you get to high school, the options just mushroom. And today with online education, and our company offers online writing classes in 3 to 6 week lengths that accommodate kids from the ages of 8 to 18. So you could take rhetorical imagination. You could take expository essay. You could take literary analysis of The Great Gatsby or Shakespeare. All of that exists now in a world that is so technologically connected, and that's how students in high school grow.
Another phone question or comment from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yeah, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I didn't hear any click. I was very fortunate in my senior year at Ann Arbor to have a world-class educator in written English. And he basically said to stick with subject, verb, object, order of sentence structure, and don't go away from that until you learn thoroughly how to communicate meaning with that form of the English sentence. And that was the emphasis of the whole semester, was to communicate meaning. And I was very, very fortunate that I had that before my regular series of years of education ended.
Okay, thanks for the thoughts, Carter. Appreciate that. Any thoughts from you on that, Julie?
It's a short thought. I have many thoughts on writing. I would say that the primary thing that I have discovered with students over the years is that people's writing voices are often devalued. And so students are hunting and pecking through the air, looking for the ideas, vocabulary, and thoughts that a teacher, quote-unquote, wants to hear. And what we try to do in our writing program is return human beings to the internal voice, their most natural, most genuine perspective and vocabulary, and we grow the writer from inside out rather than outside in. The educator whose work has meant the most to me is Peter Elbow. He is a professor emeritus from Amherst in Massachusetts. He popularized the concept of free writing. He has books like Writing with Power and Writing Without Teachers, which have become standards in the academy for, you know, college level. So his work has had a big influence on how I see writing.
And it is spelled E-L-B-O-W. It is Peter Elbow.
Just like your elbow.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Coming back to the subject of homeschooling kids, though, because I want to ask specifically for the folks who are just learning how to do this, advice for parents who see progress in a kid but feel like they, the parents, are failing.
Can you flesh that out? What do you mean by that?
Well, if the parents say, well, you know, the kid seems like they're making progress, but God, I feel like I really don't know what I'm doing. I feel like I'm failing my child here.
Oh, I gotcha. Yes. Oh, gosh, don't we feel that way in every aspect of parenting?
That's true.
Like most hours of the day? I call that parenting 101, man. I have a brand new granddaughter, and literally at the four-week checkup, my daughter-in-law said, I feel like I've failed her already. And I thought, oh, my gosh. I think if you feel that way, you're probably doing it right. It means you're conscientious. It means you care. And we're constantly tweaking and adapting to the needs of our child. So the best way to sort of quantify is something I do with my audience. We do what we call the monthly narrative. Instead of examining every single day of the week, pick one day out of a month and write what happened that day from sunup till sundown, just a 12-hour day, even into the night. Include everything. Like, over lunch, we were talking about how the virus moves from person to person. You know, later that day, we talked about Pokemon superpowers, and we calculated blah, blah, blah. Include everything. Narrate completely. You will be amazed that if you do this once a month, over the course of the year, you will discover that you are giving your children an education as rich and wide as it is deep, because our whole lives are bent on educating our children, not just school, not just homework. And we, as conscientious parents, are delivering that to them every day. So that's my encouragement.
Any particular warning signs for parents to watch out for that, like, hey, I got this knocked, you know, and they start getting overconfident?
I don't know about overconfidence. I haven't met many of those people. I'd love to meet one. But I will say this. The danger sign in any parent-child dynamic, and especially with education, is leveraging your authority over creating and building a relationship. Connection, openness, a feeling of warmth and transparency, that facilitates learning. We know from all the brain research that the fight or flight feeling does not help learning. It inhibits it. So if you're using, you know, the strong arm with your children around learning, you will actually inhibit their growth.
All right, a lot to think about, a lot for parents to do, obviously, at this point in history. The Suddenly at Home Schoolers, as Julie Bogart calls them. She is the creator of the Brave Writer Program, founder of the Homeschool Alliance, and the author of the book The Brave Learner, out last year. Julie Bogart, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
All right, it's been a pleasure. That'll do it for today's exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Stay home, stay safe. Talk to you soon on the Jefferson Exchange. Have a great day.